Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The only thing that is perhaps more popular than the song Somewhere Over the Rainbow is the movie where it came from. The Wizard of Oz celebrates 80 years since its release this week. That has fans all over the world rejoicing, especially in Oconomowoc, where it was reported that The Wizard of Oz had its world premiere at the Strand Theater in 1939. To help us go down the yellow brick road and talk about why this film has become a critical part of film and cultural history, film contributor Ryan Jay, who is also an Oz historian, joined me in the studio. But before we can get to the significance of the film, we start by dispelling the urban legend claiming Oconomowoc as the setting for The Wizard of Oz's world premiere.
I have to set the record straight about this, especially locally. It's not the world premiere that happened in Oconomowoc on August 12th. That was like a sneak preview. And actually the day before, on August 11th, the film was shown in both Kenosha and Appleton, Wisconsin, in addition to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. So there were at least three showings that we know of, two in Wisconsin and one somewhere else in the country prior to this Oconomowoc showing. There was an ad that ran in the Journal at the time calling it the world premiere. That ad was then reprinted in the 80s, thus furthering the urban legend that Oconomowoc has the rights to calling The Wizard of Oz its world premiere. Mm-hmm. But actually, the real world premiere of The Wizard of Oz took place in Hollywood at Grauman's Chinese Theater.
So the classic Hollywood world premiere we kind of think of in that quintessential
with
silver
all
screen
the press,
life.
With the red carpet, with the cast, with the official world premiere. Right. There's a difference between a sneak preview, as we now know, there's a difference with a press screening or even test screenings where they are getting reaction from audiences and then going back and re-editing the film. All of those things happened with The Wizard of Oz prior to August 17th. But a locked version of the film on August 11th and August 12th was shown at Oconomowoc, Appleton, and Kenosha.
So what would a sneak little preview have looked like? Was it in theaters? Was it a plein air kind of deal?
It was in theaters, in, you know, local theaters and cinemas, and audiences were delighted by it. I mean, you know, right away, it was a hit. And there's some press out there that The Wizard of Oz wasn't successful upon initial release. That's not true. The reviews were raves. The reaction by families and audiences were fantastic. But just because of the wartime, the film didn't stay in the theater as long as most films do. Also, it being a children's family film, it cost less than other films, so it didn't make the big box office at the time in 1939, but has since certainly recouped.
I mean, it is significant, even if technically Oconomowoc doesn't hold the title of the world premiere. You know, there's still three Wisconsin cities mm-hmm. with these sneak previews. So why did they want to test the waters with Midwesterners?
I think because it's a Kansas story, you know, and they want to go to the middle of America and not just, you know, find out what people think in the big cities. So, you know, coming to the Midwest and getting gauging interest and reaction to the film was as good as any other place.
And what do you think makes this film so special and quintessential? I mean, obviously, you're a historian. It's garnered further study just on its own. But just as a huge part of American culture, why is it still celebrated to this degree today, 80 years later?
Well, for me personally, it's my favorite movie. And it's the reason that I was interested in all of entertainment, you know, my whole life and kind of, you know, guided me into a career of entertainment journalism. But the reason that I think it's become so successful and remains so successful 80 years later and counting is because it's the very definition of iconic. You know, we toss that word around, but there's nothing, you know, there's a reason why the Academy revisits the ruby slippers as part of their logo for their upcoming Academy Museum, or that The Wizard of Oz is celebrated on its anniversaries, continues to get repackaged for new generations and new versions. And it's something like a rite of passage that has become something that we all love and then we share with the future generations and experiencing it through their eyes for the first time. But The Wizard of Oz, as an iconic property, not only is it a perfect film, considering the casting, the makeup, the costuming, the locations, all of the real practical special effects because computers weren't around then to be doing all the CGI, but it all holds up. Like if you compare it to today's greatest CGI films, it's still as entertaining. It's still as beautiful and as convincing as an entertainment. So that perfect nature of cast and script and story and song, you know, is very, very rare in film history. That's number one. Number two, it has been scientifically proven through researchers and scientists in Italy in an independent study as the most influential film of all time. And that's not only because of how it's influenced other films, but the way that it's influenced all of pop culture, from politics to television, songs, movies, other stage productions. Look at Wicked, still running on Broadway, is one of the most successful shows in musical theater history, The Wiz. We look at other TV shows that have spawned from it, miniseries, other movies, prequels, sequels, whether they're successful or not. It is so influential. And also things that have nothing to do with The Wizard of Oz. News, other genres of film refer to it, whether it's We're Not in Kansas Anymore or There's No Place Like Home or I'll Get You My Pretty and You're a Little Dog Too or Over the Rainbow. Interestingly, the word rainbow never appears once in the L. Frank Baum book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, the novel that the movie The Wizard of Oz is based upon. And further, a rainbow visually never appears anywhere in the film The Wizard of Oz. Yet the song Over the Rainbow is so influential as the most celebrated song in movie history and one of the most covered songs of all music history that it's rare to not think of a rainbow when you think of The Wizard of Oz. And there are places in the world where Over the Rainbow is known as a song and they don't even know the film.
You mentioned its influence not just on pop culture, but I'm sure on movie production itself. So during its time of production before its release in 1939, what kind of challenges did this movie's production face? And what kind of things did the filmmakers of Wizard of Oz, that they were truly pioneers in this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there were a lot of challenges. There were several different directors that worked on this film. You know, we hear about, you know, trials and tribulations of film today where a director for one reason or another is taken off a project and another one has gone in. But it's rare to see five different directors work on a project. It's also rare to have, you know, one person usually or two gets credited with writing the screenplay, but there were a slew of people that had influence over the screenplay for The Wizard of Oz, including Yip Harburg, the lyricist of all the songs, who wrote several of the key moments in the film, including when the wizard is handing out the diploma, the badge of courage, and the heart to our, you know, Dorothy's three friends. He wrote all of that dialogue for the wizard, and now when you rewatch it, it does kind of play back sort of lyrically and mesmerizingly. There's also there were many challenges with the effects because they were doing them practically. First of all, like even with the makeup, the Tin Man was originally cast as Buddy Ebsen, and the makeup, you know, what he was inhaling, it was his powdered silver before they realized they needed to keep it in, you know, pounded into a paste to use on Jack Haley, the replacement casting, which was great because I can't imagine the film without Jack Haley, mm-hmm. you know, so kind of one of those everything for a reason things. But also Margaret Hamilton, the Wicked Witch of the West, had to leave production for a while because in the screen used take of the film in Munchkinland, when the witch is leaving, you see a plume of fire go up. That fire is not supposed to be there. It was just supposed to be the red smoke, but that she was burned by that fire and had to leave production and had burns on her face and stuff. So it was very, very problematic along the way. There were problems with reshoots and style of what Dorothy was going to look like. She was blonde with a prosthetic nose at one point. The Yellow Brick Road under the direction of Richard Thorpe looked like rounded bricks instead of like almost, you know, cobblestones instead of actual brick shape rectangles. The Scarecrow and the Tin Man and the Lion, they all shifted in their direction and how they came to look. And so it's really a great tale looking at the making of The Wizard of Oz, of things happening for a reason. You know, for those of us who believe that sort of thing, because if any one of these things didn't happen the way it did, the film might not have the legs that it's had. It might not have touched the way that it has touched. And, you know, so it really turned out to be exactly what it was supposed to be, and it has its own place in all of our hearts.
Well, and that's kind of spectacular considering how morale on a set can plummet the production value, you know, because it translates on screen. If people are experiencing difficulties, if there's five different directors, if someone gets burned and can't come back to work, considering all those trials, did people involved in production and the cast think like, oh, this is going to be a flop? What are we doing with all of our time here?
I don't have any information about that. I mean, who's to say, you know, we live in a different time now where with social media and everything else, stars themselves are posting and able to talk about, and interviews go deeper about certain things. the Hollywood and the press machine back in 1939 was very superficial and more just promotional about, you know, the film, the big spectacle of The Wizard of Oz. And they wouldn't, you know, reveal in the moment. You know, these stories and these behind the scenes things are that we've uncovered along the way. So it's hard to say what morale was like. But I do know that many of the people, including Ray Bolger, fought to be in the film, fought to have that role. He was originally cast as the Tin Man, but then went and said, I want to be the Scarecrow. I want to be the one to follow Dorothy the longest down the Yellow Brick Road. He wanted that much more screen time and to be in the film that much longer out of his love and respect for Oz. The same with Judy Garland. She was a fan of the books. You know, she grew up enjoying the story and was so excited to get this role. And it meant a lot for her and her career. And obviously, even later in her career, after she became Judy Garland, mm-hmm. you know, she's still always very much revered and respected who Dorothy was, that story, and what Over the Rainbow meant to her in her career.
You mentioned the influence of the books. Considering films can capture a book sometimes really well, other times not very well, there's always the argument of like, oh, you need to read the book first, or the book is better. So when it comes to adaptation and screenplays of this work, how do you think it fares?
It's such a good question because, I mean, we always hear the book is better, right? And oftentimes it's true. And I'm a huge Harry Potter fan, and I love the Harry Potter movies, but I just wish that those movies were all like 7 hours longer so that they would have included that much more that was cut out. But those are cases where they were very truly adapted to screen, and there were things cut out, but pretty much almost nothing was changed. It is so the opposite with The Wizard of Oz. The film is so different than the original book. There are no farmhands that become the Scarecrow, Tin Man, and Lion. There's no Miss Gulch in the book. When Dorothy and her friends go to meet the wizard, they don't just see a big head. They see the wizard takes on different forms as appearing to the different characters. Also, when going to find the Wicked Witch of the West, it's not just the winged monkeys they encounter, but the Wicked Witch of the West sends out crows and wolves and bees to try to conquer Dorothy and her friends before getting to the Wicked Witch of the West, who, by the way, isn't even green in the book. And the ruby slippers aren't ruby. They were turned ruby by MGM for the color of the film being one of the very first color films being made. They were silver shoes in the book. It couldn't be more different. There's a lot cut out. The tone, Dorothy's much younger and blonde. And it's very, very different. And Dorothy's journey is very different, not to mention it's not musicalized in the novel. But can we imagine, I mean, you really can't, what The Wizard of Oz would be without Follow the Yellow Brick Road, If I Only Had a Brain, Ding Dong, The Witch is Dead, and of course, Over the Rainbow. It's changed the world. So it's one case where I think the movie is much better than the book. And I love the book.
With us celebrating the 80th anniversary coming up, I'm curious, what's your first Oz memory?
Gosh, it has to be watching The Wizard of Oz with my parents in the family room. And I had at the time some of these dolls. They were made by Mego. They're actually being remade right now and carried at Target. This company is back and remanufacturing these dolls. But these are the dolls that I played with in the late 70s, early 80s. Because, you know, before DVD and VHS and CD and MP3 and all the rest of it, movies were not available. And you had to, like, hold your breath and wait to see a movie. And The Wizard of Oz was one movie that was broadcast annually. And it was like Christmas or Thanksgiving or Halloween. It was something I would plan for. When I would see the ad in TV Guide that The Wizard of Oz was coming up in a few weeks, I'd tear it out and tape it on my bedroom wall waiting for this movie.
Yeah.
You know? And so it was event television. And, you know, now we only have that with like the live musicals or with the Olympics. But I think that we all, those of us in a certain generation who retain that special quality for The Wizard of Oz, you know, hope to. Disney does it with their vault. They take movies away and create a hunger and a thirst for
yeah.
it. And it's really brilliant marketing. And I think that that's important. Not that I'm arguing
it's
for
true.
People to pull The Wizard of Oz away from
right.
us to make us want it. But it's, you know, it's an interesting time.
With your work as an Oz historian, you've traveled to a lot of places. So I'm curious, you know, what are some of the ways people continue to celebrate this film outside of its anniversary?
Cosplay, right? I mean, just look at like perennial Halloween costumes. We see new costumes every year for what's hot. But there's a few properties that every year those characters are there. And The Wizard of Oz is one of them. Every year we see, you know, the Warner Brothers Wizard of Oz characters, the MGM Wizard of Oz characters. And so I think cosplay, there's always a costume competition. There are parades. It's fun to get together and watch the film or talk about other aspects of Oz, like whether it was Disney's prequel, Oz the Great and Powerful, that came out in 2013, or 1985's Disney sequel, Return to Oz, that has become a cult classic. You know, I've found some of the celebrities and stars from Broadway, whether it's Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel, to film, whether it's Emma Ridley from Return to Oz or James Franco, Mila Kunis from Oz the Great and Powerful, and even TV shows, what, you know, like Vincent D'Onofrio and Audria Arjona from NBC's short-lived one-season Emerald City TV series, you know, interviewing them and then taking those interviews and talking about these other Oz properties with Oz fans around the country is always really fun. And just Oz-themed things, like there's a Midwest Wizard of Oz Fest near Chicago, Wamego, Kansas, has the Oz Museum, which is glorious. It's like a walkthrough of the film. And I've been honored to have my handprints and autograph in the cement there right next to Jerry Marin, who's the Middle Lollipop Guild Munchkin from The Wizard of Oz, and some other Oz people that I very much respect. There's the All Things Oz Museum and Oz Stravaganza in Chittenango, New York, which is the birthplace of L. Frank Baum, does a really great one. And then there's also the Wizard of Oz Club, the International Wizard of Oz Club, which has a website, ozclub.org, which I'm a board member of, and people can join, and they put out a magazine that's three times a year called The Baum Bugle with really great information, and they hold their own, like, conventions where people get together and geek out for a whole weekend all across the country. They pick different cities every year to do really fun Oz things.
Well, here's to all the geeking out that's going to happen this coming week with the 80th anniversary. Ryan, thanks so much for coming in and sharing a little more about this movie that we all know and love.
Oh, thank you too. To Oz.
Ryan Jay is one of our regular film contributors and an Oz historian. The Wizard of Oz turns 80 this week, and you can find more information at wuwm.com.